Hi, this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. Hey, this is Craig Valentine. I'm here with my friend, mentor, and his name is Xander Fryer, and he's going to teach you about stuff you don't learn in college. What do you call it?
Shit you don't learn in college.
Right. And he's also going to talk about two of the toughest times of his life, the DWI or DUI.
Whatever you want to call
yes.
it. Same thing.
And then how his friend AJ, you know, a real tough moment in that man's life led to Xander going through like the lowest of his lows, but it also got him through to the other side. And he's going to deliver absolute value in here about how you can change your mindset, take faster action, and succeed in every area of life. What is it? It's stuff you don't learn in college, helps you with money.
More money, more meaning, and more freedom.
Yeah. So, hey, let's live free and jump into this one. Xander, my man, welcome to the Early to Rise radio show. We're on the road this week in your office.
Yeah, thanks for coming here.
This is going to be a lot of fun. And first of all, I want to know how you fought the law and you won around your new book, the title, the trademark. You actually went to the Supreme Court on this. So, I mean, I haven't, fortunately, had to have any fights like that. What the heck were you fighting for? Why? And what did you win?
So the name of the book is Shit You Don't Learn in College. And so...
To be known as Stuff You Didn't Learn in College for the remainder of the Early to Rise podcast.
For the remainder of the Early to Rise podcast. Stuff You Did Not Learn in College. Essentially,
the U.S. government
the U.S. government was not happy with that name either. So basically,
but why?
So when I originally applied for the U.S. Trademark and patent for it, I got a very lengthy letter. Like I think it was like 12 or 16 pages long.
No way.
Oh yeah. This was not like a, you were denied. This was like a,
we all pay taxes for
like
someone to write this 12-page
letter.
You're
denied, and I hate you, and you're a terrible person.
Right. But why?
So
why?
Basically, they said that the idea of stuff you do not learn in college, stuff you don't learn in college.
The other S word.
The
right.
other S word was lewd and offensive to the idea of higher education.
That's amazing.
Which is literally the reason for the book. It's
right.
a little bit ironic because the reason that they were saying that, you know, the politics and the red tape were saying I couldn't do this was the reason that I was writing this book.
Right, because you find the idea of mandatory higher education or that, you know, if you don't have higher education, you can't do anything. You find that lewd and offensive.
I find it lewd and offensive that there's people that are going into hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt to get a degree that after they go get the degree, like one of the things that's crazy to me is right now, this is as of like 2019, Gallup did a poll that they found 27% of people who got a degree in a specific area are actually in a job that requires that degree. 27%. So about 1 out of 4.
Right. So probably engineers, doctors, accountants.
40% are in a job that does not require a degree.
A degree at all.
Huh. So more people are working at Starbucks with degrees and $100,000 in debt than people that are actually in a job that requires that degree right now.
Wow. Okay. So you said, I want to get this trademark U.S. government for stuff you don't learn in college. They send you a 12 or 16 page letter that says, we ain't giving it to you, Mr. Fryer.
Yep.
And you did then what?
So I hired an attorney. You know, a lot of this was basically like at this point, this had nothing to do with my business at this point.
Right.
This was more like out of principle. I was just like, how can you tell me that I can't get a trademark for this when literally the First Amendment is like freedom of speech, right? How can you say that I can't trademark this? And so I hired an attorney and we ended up taking it to court. And as we took it to court, we ended up finding out that there were other people that were offended by the U.S. Patent and Trade Office had said, they couldn't say certain things. And
what do you mean? Like other people had tried?
Other people had tried to go to the U.S. Patent and Trade Office and been denied for, you know, maybe they said something offensive in their language or something like that for the same reasons.
Around education specifically.
Not specifically around education, but just anything in general.
Oh.
And so we ended up actually forming a little group and doing a basically taking that to the U.S. Supreme Court, which eventually ruled that it was unconstitutional for the U.S. Patent and Trade Office to deny us the right to a trademark simply because we were lewd or offensive or had a curse word in the name or something like that. And eventually we're able to actually get the trademark.
And that took how long and cost how much?
Two and a half years. Only ended up costing about $10,000. But it was, it's interesting for me because like, as I'm growing my business, this was $10,000 that was going nowhere. This is a sunk cost for pretty much no reason other than the fact that like, I knew that like, this was out of principle. Somebody had to do something about this.
Right. But also now you, well, I mean, you could have used the book title anyways.
Yes.
You just couldn't have had a trademark.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So what the heck is in this book? And and in this book, what are the, what's the like most valuable or applicable lesson to what you just did?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things, you know, one of the things that I always tell people is like, at the very core of it, we don't really understand where our education system came from. Do you know where our education system came from or how we got to the education system we're in right now?
No, absolutely.
So the, you know, one of the most applicable lessons, I'll get to it in just a second, but you kind of have to understand why our education system is the way that it is right now. So if you go back to ancient Greece, you go back to like Plato's Republic, Socrates, Plato, the way that the education system was originally designed, like that was the original Western education system. It was something called the trivium. So the trivium is basically three main principles that you would master over the course of a decade, two decades, right? And you basically just master these three things. Now, the three things were grammar, which is essentially the ability to learn, right? So read, write, the ability to learn on your own. Logic, which is the ability to reason on your own. And rhetoric, the ability to critically think on something and re-deliver it.
Okay.
So in Plato's Republic and in ancient Greece, you would study these three things over the course of a decade, multiple decades. And when you mastered them, they would consider you a successful individual contributing member of society.
Wow.
Right? That's what you would focus on before you went on to anything specific, is mastering those three tools. Now, when you start to look at imperialistic Rome, right? What's imperialistic Rome is militaristic. They're expansionist. So they need a lot of soldiers, right? Well, what makes a terrible soldier?
Being able to think.
Someone who learns on their own, someone who reasons on their own, and someone who critically thinks, asks a lot of questions, right, and can re-deliver new knowledge to everybody else.
Right.
So essentially, once you get into Rome, when you start to look at what makes good worker bees or worker ants, they got rid of this whole system and they started focusing on something called objective-based learning.
Okay.
Right, where they're essentially teaching you through rote repetition to like get a specific outcome, and that's it. Be a one-trick pony, and that's all you can do.
So you could have named the book "Stuff You Didn't Learn in Rome."
Yes, you could have.
Right,
absolutely. But that's essentially, if you think about it, that's where our modern-day education systems comes from. Everything back in Rome. Now we're obviously not in a militaristic society, but look at capitalism. Capitalism is amazing. Right, it's provided so many, you know, so many growth opportunities in technology and healthcare and everything that we do. You know, so standard of living has, you know, grown across the world drastically because of it. But at the same time, you look at the individual, and they're the ones paying the prices. Right. So while we've never been more comfortable and more safe than ever, anxiety and depression is at an all-time high. Suicide rates are at an all-time high. You know, Forbes did a study recently and they found that 87% of all people in 9-to-5s are disconnected, disengaged, anxious, stressed, depressed, and don't want to be there.
And this was before COVID.
This was before COVID.
Right.
87%. So only 13% of the population is actually happy and fulfilled in what they're doing at work.
Hmm.
Right. And that's where you spend a high majority of your time. And a majority of this is because our entire education system is built to create worker bees or worker ants, rather than helping everybody become individual contributing members of society. So the lesson here that applies to what I did with shit you don't learn in college, stuff you don't learn in college, sorry, is, you know, critical thought, like just the ability to question, like, is this right?
Mm-hmm.
Is this okay? Can we do something different? And I think with everything going on in the world right now, everybody's kind of, you know, following the herd rather than just being like, hey, is this right? Mm-hmm. Is this the right thing to do? Maybe do a little bit of your own research, learn on your own, reason on your own, critically think and ask questions before you make decisions on what you should be doing.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of people are maybe even try to, but then they get smacked down when they,
yeah.
Like there's definitely a lot of smacking down when you kind of poke your head up and ask a question or two.
Well, one of the biggest things that we talk about in the book, and this is a reason why it's so hard for people to critically question, especially when herd mentality is going a certain way. So Dr. David Hawkins talks about this in Power Versus Force, but one of the lowest energetic emotions that we can have as humans is shame.
Oh.
And at the core of shame is social shame, other people not approving of you.
Right.
So evolutionarily, where this comes from, it comes from, you know, if you think about like evolutionary man to survive, you're in small groups, you're in tribes. So you don't want to be outcast. You don't want to be ashamed of something. You don't want to be outcast because being on your own with saber-toothed tigers out there means you're probably going to die, right? Being in a group keeps you safe.
Yeah.
So shame is very closely tied to, if you feel ashamed, it's really close to the feeling of you're going to die, right? And shame actually is one of the leading reasons for suicide. People will feel so ashamed of the weight and the burden that they have put on their friends and family or whatever it might be because of their depression or anything that's going on, that they would take their own life. So they would prefer death to actually feeling ashamed.
Yeah, I remember somebody I knew said they got COVID and they passed it on to their family member. And they said, if like they died, I probably would have killed myself.
Yeah.
Because like, it's the shame. And then I often talk about how when someone is found out as a hypocrite or even feels like a hypocrite, that's like, you know, ranked in society, like lower than if you stole somebody's purse. Sometimes.
Which is crazy,
yeah.
Right? It's like if, you know, if people are honest about stealing the purse, then it's totally fine. But a hypocrite?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So who are you and why did you write this book? You know, quick little background of Xander. Who, you know,
that's
you,
a great question.
You have been on the Early to Rise podcast
yeah.
a couple times, but it's been a while. We talked about mostly about sales in those past episodes. Now, tell us a little bit more about yourself. Briefly,
yeah.
What you're doing today, because it's been a couple years, and then why did you write this book?
Yeah, you know, I wrote this book, and this will kind of tell who I am, where I am now, and why I wrote the book altogether. So about 5 years ago, I was still at Cisco Systems, so I was a quote-unquote successful person in my
Because business. You actually did go through college, you got
I went through
engineering.
College, I went through UCLA, got an electrical engineering degree. Yeah. I did everything that everybody told me would make you successful, right? I worked at Cisco. I made, I made around $250,000 a year.
Yeah.
I worked with companies like Disney, ABC, Facebook, Sony, Verizon, you name it. Those were my clients.
Right.
I, as a kid in his mid-20s, when I was 26 years old, I had a standing meeting with the Disney CIO. And I drove a BMW. I lived in Venice Beach. Like I had what everybody was telling me was quote unquote success. And I felt empty. I felt every raise I'd get, every promotion I'd get, you know, it'd be like, yay, more money. And then I'd go spend it at the bar because I was trying to fill a hole
mm-hmm.
of like, what am I actually doing with my life?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it took a really jarring conversation with one of my mentors to help me realize that, like, I needed to do something different. One of my mentors actually asked me, you know, Xander, what would you do if you couldn't fail? And this was, I was still in 9-to-5 at that time. And this mentor of mine was a health and wellness mentor who had a 7-figure business over in England. And he said, what would you do if you couldn't fail? And I told him, I said, I don't know. I'd like mentor people, I guess. Like I love mentoring people. I was like, I was in the Air Force. I was in Air Force ROTC and I loved leading people. I got a DUI my senior year. So I got kicked out of the Air Force. That kind of ruined that path for me. But I said, you know, ever since I've been kicked out of the Air Force, like I just miss leading and helping other people. And he said, well, why don't you go do that? And I said, what do you mean? Like a Tony Robbins? Like I can't be Tony Robbins, right? I had all the excuses in my brain. And he goes, well, why don't you just go figure it out? I was like, well, I've got this great job. I'm making all this great money. I've got this great path laid out ahead of me. And he said, Xander, just because you've got a path in front of you, does that mean you should walk it? And he said, one of the things that he told me, he said, you know, when you get to my age, Xander, you'll realize really quickly that one of the resources you'll never get back is your time. And every moment off purpose is a moment wasted.
Hmm.
And that really stuck with me because, you know, he was at that point pointing out to me that, like, you know, the one day I was going to die, and I would look back and would I be happy with the decisions that I made to go down? And he said, you know, Xander, you know the difference between you and me. And I said, well, you make more money than I do. And he said, the real difference between you and me is I'm actually living my dream. And ever since you got kicked out of the Air Force, you're just dreaming a dream.
Hmm.
And so I quit 2 days later.
Wow.
And I started my entrepreneurial journey with no idea what I was doing. But over the last 4.5 years, we've built a multi 7-figure coaching business. So I've now coached over 800 people to build successful entrepreneurial lives, mm-hmm. six figure, multiple six figure, seven figures.
Yep. You've even coached my wife, Michelle.
Coached your wife, Michelle.
I mean, we've hired you for consulting.
Yep. We've worked with a lot of different people. And I think, you know, this is where, for me, as I was going through this process of, you know, I spent $120,000 of my own money. I paid for my college. I spent $120,000 of my own money to go through school to get a degree that was supposed to give me a life that was going to make me feel happy and successful, and mm-hmm. it didn't. Mm-hmm. And over the last, you know, 4.5 years, I ran the numbers, and it's somewhere around I've spent $500,000 working on my own personal development in programs, mentorship, hiring people like yourself, our good friend Bedros, mm-hmm. Mastermind programs, like, you know, the programs that we're in together. So I've spent nearly $500,000 now that I actually know what my purpose is in life, in learning how to really build a life with more money, more meaning, and more freedom. And to the point where we've actually been able to replicate that with hundreds and hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to take those systems and now put it into this book, Shit You Don't Learn in College, to actually get it to a broader audience.
Got it. And you have a podcast, same title.
Same title.
Same
yep.
thing.
And same, you know, so we're interviewing a lot of entrepreneurs, health and wellness experts, professional athletes, professional musicians, to really get down to the nitty gritty of what it actually means to be successful in life. Because I think, you know, a broader part of the world, again, they did a Gallup in that study found that 49% of America today says that college is not necessary. So half of America now agrees that college is not necessary. And in fact, 61% of people who have college degrees say that they would either like to go back and basically go back in time and either get a different degree or not get a degree at all.
Interesting. So you get that DUI in your senior year of college.
Yeah.
What's the lesson from stuff you don't learn in college that applied to that? Because I know they sure as heck didn't teach you, like, when do you get arrested? You know, I didn't take that class. I'm sure you didn't take that class.
Yeah. So
how do you get back on track is really
the
question.
So there's two major lessons, and we actually talk about this in the book. There's two major lessons for me getting my DUI that are pivotal to being successful. The first one is we always talk about taking full ownership.
Okay.
Right. So everything in your life is your fault, whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether
sure.
it's mediocre, it is all your fault. Which is really hard for a lot of people to hear, you know, because if somebody, say, for example, somebody gets cancer,
sure.
right? Like, can you really say that that's my fault? Or you get hit by a car? Is that really that your husband or your wife has a tragic accident? Is that really your fault? Maybe not, but you are still in control of how you respond to that situation,
right.
how you feel about that situation, the stories you tell yourself about that situation, and what you do next, right? So, you know, I tell people, you know, when I got my DUI, and it's like, when you hear the story, so I'll tell you the story of how I got my DUI. I've never had a beer and driven before in my entire life. Never, right? A lot of people, when they're kids, they'll have a couple beers, they'll go drive, and they'll get away with it for a while. Not once. I was the goody two-shoes that never had a beer and drove.
Right.
And then I was home from UCLA visiting some friends, and we went out to a bar, and I parked my car at my buddy's place with all intention of leaving it there. And we had 3 beers. And my buddy, whose house we just came from, which was about 20 minutes away, his mom is a quadriplegic. And he had put her in the bathtub with expecting his dad to come home and get her out.
Oh.
And his dad called and said, I'm not going to be able to get her out. And my buddy, Sam, was basically like, Xander, I know you never drink and drive. We're college kids at this point. We don't have money for a taxi, right? So I know you don't drink and drive, but, like, can you take me back to the house? And I said, yes. And so I, thinking that I'm being a good Samaritan... go for a drive. There's a DUI checkpoint. They pull me over. I blow a .09,
and
which is 1% over the legal limit. And that's the end of my Air Force career.
And that's after you dropped them off or before?
Before.
Ugh.
Yeah. So, so that's how I got my DUI. Now, the lesson from this for me was taking ownership. So I took ownership and I went to the Air Force and I told them everything. I was forward. I was open and honest about everything. I had character references from my colonel, from a one-star general, and from my captain saying basically like to the Air Force, you gotta keep this guy in. Mm-hmm. And they didn't keep me in.
No, they didn't keep you in because that was just...
Because
that was the rule.
Hard rule.
Right? Oh, okay, give them credit for that.
Got to give them credit for that. I'm never upset with the Air Force with what they did. I'm still... My only regret in life so far is that I did not get to serve my country. I think that's something that I wish I could have done. Mm-hmm. But I look at this and me being truthful. So I found out about a year later, had I not told the Air Force, they actually would have never found out because I ended up getting the DUI expunged. So they actually would have never found out. I took ownership over it. When I got kicked out, I actually went in front of my detachment of 270 people and I told them the whole story. And this was a 21-year-old kid. And I went to this detachment that at that point I was the leader of, and I was going to tell everybody that I was getting kicked out for a stupid decision that I made to make sure that everybody there didn't make the same decision.
Okay.
So when I did that, so I took ownership.
Yeah.
And then the second thing that I did was realizing that everything that happens in my life does happen for a good reason. Now you might not always see it right away, but it's really hard to see it when you're face down in the mud, but it always happens for a good reason. First thing is telling everybody there, I guarantee helped prevent somebody else from making the same mistake.
Sure.
I had a buddy of mine from the Air Force reach out to me about 3 years ago just to tell me how much that talk meant to him.
Wow.
The second part is I would not be here doing what I am today had I not gotten that DUI. I would still be in the Air Force. I'd probably be flying planes, right? And you can't see that until you actually go 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, right? And to be able to do that, so you have to take ownership over your life. And then the second lesson there is you have to, you know, the word is faith, right? Not religion. It's not dogma. It's faith. You have to have faith that the things that you go through, the struggle that you go through becomes your story down the line.
You can't really look at it any other way.
Yeah.
Because, somebody could sit here and argue, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, you can't look at it any other way because if you do, you just waste so much energy. And it's like, okay, great. So this is teaching me a lesson. What's the lesson for me to learn here?
And then let me move forward. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think for me, I always tell people, like, I think I just watched too many Disney movies growing up. Because, like, every time something bad has happened to me, I still remember when I was 21 years old and I was sitting in the drunk tank. I was obviously bawling my eyes out. Because I knew that I just ruined my career in the Air Force. But I still remember thinking, like, this has to benefit me somehow in the future. This is happening for a reason, right? Because I think I've just watched so many Disney movies that I'm always like, whatever the crap that I go through, however bad it gets, there's a reason. There's a reason down the line. I will come out of this pit of despair, and I will come out the victor, just like every single Disney movie.
There's, I don't know if you've ever heard this old, I think it's a Chinese story, and it's like, this man and his son are farmers, and this, this wild horse comes along, and they get a horse, and all the villagers go, oh, this is great news. And the old man goes, we'll see. And then the young man is trying to tame the horse, and he falls off and he breaks his ankle or breaks his leg. And everyone goes, oh, this is such bad news. And he says, oh, we'll see.
Yeah.
And then the generals come in and they're recruiting, or the army comes in, they're recruiting young men to go off and fight in this war. And his son can't go because he has a broken leg. And everyone says, oh, this is good news. And the man just says, we'll see.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that's like the most applicable parable to what we're living in the world right now. Like everybody's going, oh, look at us. We're doing great. And it's like, we'll see.
Yeah, this is
going
to happen and this can happen.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, Australia, we were talking about that on the way here because your wife is from Australia. Like Australia for a long time was gloating. And now it's like, okay, we'll see what happens next. Like this whole COVID thing is not going to end anytime soon. So it's like all these people who are going, look at how great we're doing. We'll see.
Yeah.
And you got to be very careful about that in every area of life. But it's similar to what you said. And again, at the end of the day, if somebody knocks you down, you can't worry about it. You can't, feel woe is me because it just doesn't do you any good. You have to go, as you said, there's got to be a lesson in here somewhere.
Yeah.
Which actually reminds me of another story that, this kid is expecting a pony on it for Christmas, And he goes in, and under the Christmas tree is a giant pile of pony crap. And the kid starts digging, or just a pile of crap. And the kid starts digging, and they go, "What are you doing?" He goes, "Well, there's got to be a pony in here somewhere."
Yeah.
Right? So that is the that is how you look at that. So then that's not even like, you know, quote unquote, the most defining, the most pivotal moment in your life. It's a couple years later when your friend AJ commits suicide. AJ was in the Army?
He was in the Marines.
Marines went to Iraq?
He actually never deployed. He got sent back because of mental and physical. He got put out because of his mental and physical issues, yeah.
Okay, and so those were pre-existing?
Yes.
Okay. So so AJ, your best friend, you know, was in the Army, doesn't deploy. He's got anxiety, depression.
Yep.
And then what happens?
Yeah, so
how do you respond to it?
Yeah, so he struggled with that for about 10 years until taking his life just around 4 years ago, four and a half years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And before he killed himself, you know, we had always talked about, you know, he's, in my opinion, he was my first coach. He was my first mentor.
Got it.
I remember, you know, we first met like 8 years old. We played baseball together, played soccer together, you know, went to every school together. In high school, he introduced me to my first girlfriend. In high school, I was the nerdy kid and AJ was the outgoing guy that everybody loved.
Huh.
Right. And so, you know, he was the mentor that was like, taught me how to like, you know, be social and like talk to people and make friends and things like that. And he was always loving. He was always a light, always, you know, brought energy to any situation. But, you know, one of the things, and this comes back to that whole shame thing for him, it was, you know, the world, school, everything was always trying to put him in this box of how he needed to behave and who he needed to be. And because of that, he would always fail at things, but he didn't want to appear a failure because everybody loved him. So he would actually just bury this stuff deeper and deeper. And we talked about this, you know, within the 6 months right before he ended up taking his own life, we talked a lot about how, you know, he felt he'd always been kind of like misunderstood by the school system, by everything like that. And it just created so much internal stress and so much shame and so much anxiety. And that's, you know, he felt that that was a lot of the root of where all of his addictive tendencies and everything came from, until it culminated in him actually taking his own life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was by far the hardest thing that I've been through. And
you're still at Cisco at this time?
This is after Cisco, just after
Cisco.
Cisco.
Okay.
So this is, I had just left Cisco. I had just started my coaching business.
Got it.
So literally, you know, first four months of me starting my coaching business, I had probably just started making my first like paychecks as a coach. And here I was with a handful of coaches and a handful of clients, and some of them that I was coaching they had PTSD, and I'd helped them through PTSD, and I'd helped them through trauma, and I'd helped a couple people through suicidal tendencies.
Wow.
But I didn't help AJ. I couldn't help my best friend.
Right.
And that created...
Because at that time, you were more of a life coach?
At that point, I was a life coach. So, you know, cliche millennial quits corporate job to start life coaching business.
Right.
Only difference was I actually knew how to make money.
Got it.
So I created this belief, this fear, this anxiety... around, you know, after AJ took his own life, I'm a fraud. I like anybody I work with, like there's a chance that they're going to die.
Right.
Right. Now I know logically that's not true, but like, it was so deeply emotional, right? And this is something we dig into in the book, right? Like we're never given an instruction manual for our brain.
Of course. Right? Not.
You're given an instruction manual for your TV, for even for like your dishwasher, right? But you're never given an instruction manual for your brain, which 95% of your brain is subconscious. 95%, right? So only 5% of your brain you consciously have control over, yet you're never given an instruction manual for how to handle the other 95.
So before we unpack that, what does it mean, like the 95%, the subconscious? What is the subconscious mind doing to a lot of us?
Oh, it's dictating everything. So the subconscious is what runs your emotions. The subconscious is what runs all of your habits. So somewhere between 50 to 90% of all your actions are habitual, right? So like, do you remember brushing your teeth this morning?
I brushed them twice actually far.
but were you conscious of exactly how you were doing it? It just kind of happened,
right?
You know, I tell same thing with like driving, right? Like You know, when you first started driving, you're so aware, right? You're like, right, buckle, like mirrors, blinkers, like hands at 10 and 2. You're very conscious.
But and now when you're on the highway, you're like, whoa, did I fall asleep for the last 30 miles?
You and I were driving up here having a detailed conversation on a bunch of different stuff. I'm driving manual. We've got music in the background. Like, we're doing so many different things.
Yeah.
And I'm operating a multiple thousand pound vehicle going 80 miles an hour on the freeway.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's crazy. That's all subconscious.
Sure.
Right? So 95% of your brain dictates a high majority of your life. The random thoughts that you think, how you respond when somebody says something a certain way, the beliefs that you have, the emotions you feel, that's all subconscious.
Like the eye roll that people
don't
even know they're doing.
Yes. It just happens automatically. But
that causes so much trouble when, like, you know, your spouse says something and you subconsciously eye roll. You're not like,
yeah,
I don't want to start a fight. But consciously, I don't want to start a fight, but the person
it's still going to happen, right? And so the thing that I always tell people, right, if you think about that subconscious, we all want to accomplish our goals in life, whatever they might be. But imagine you have five horses that are like thoroughbred horses. They're like racers. And you're on a chariot with five of these thoroughbred horses and you want to race off to your goals. But those five horses are chained to 95 donkeys. And those 95 donkeys are sitting there doing nothing, or even worse, walking the other direction.
Right.
Right. Our subconscious has been programmed by society, by media, by our parents, by school growing up. And it has not been programmed to help you become the individual contributing member of society that succeeds in everything they want that you want to be.
Right.
Right. We just talked about that. So that 95% is all donkeys walking the other direction. The five horses, it doesn't matter how many steroids you give them, they will not beat the 95 donkeys.
Got it.
Right? And so, you know, the big thing and kind of the lesson here that we talk about in the book as well is, like, you need to understand your brain because you need to be able to reprogram it. You need to get those 95 donkeys to start to walk the same direction as the five horses so that you can actually accomplish your goals. Now, for me, how this came about when I lost AJ was it sent me in a deep, dark depression, right? That emotional scarring of losing your best friend, like, it hit so deep on a subconscious level that it turned my entire identity around, right? So that 95% of me was in complete turmoil. Before that, I was successful. I had made great money. After that, I was lost.
Got it.
I doubted everything that I did. I didn't even know who I was as a person anymore, right? I was lonely. I was frustrated. I resented my best friend for killing himself and taking him from this world. And then I felt guilty about feeling resentful of somebody who felt so demonized that he had to take his own life.
Right.
And then I felt shitty for feeling guilty and feeling like I felt all of these things. And had I not had the power to understand what was going on in my brain, I would not have made it out of there. And I understand why so many people don't make it out of there, because they're not given this instruction manual.
Right. Because, like, when you're in a bottomless pit, how does one get out of a bottomless pit?
And if you understand how to build a ladder with what's in the bottomless pit, you'll be able to start to build your way out. But, you know, it took me a lot of time. It took me a lot of work of, like, reprogramming my subconscious mind. But because I knew how to do it, because I had the tools, I was able to do it.
So practical, like, somebody's in a bad spot right now for whatever reason, you know, lost money or sickness or, like, you know, 19 things went wrong on one day. How do they reverse it, even in the tiniest bit?
Yeah. So there's two major things that you can do to reverse it, even in the tiniest bit. The first thing that I always tell people is, and this is something that you've preached for years, is action first, right? So there's something that we teach called the cycle of outcomes, where you have an event that happens in your life. That event creates a story or a belief that goes on in your head, which creates an emotion of how you feel, which then creates an action you take, which creates another outcome.
Got it.
Right? Now, a lot of people, and Tony Robbins will say, you know, you have to have different beliefs to create different outcomes, right? Well, that's true. But what if you could just take a different action, which created a different belief immediately? So the example I always give is, you know, when I was 10 years old, I wanted to jump off a high dive, right? And I go up to the top of the high dive, right? And as a 10-year-old kid, you look off the high dive and you're about peeing yourself.
Right.
Because you're like, the stories are going through your head. I'm going to fall off this thing, or I'm going to break a leg. And then I'm going to be so ashamed that nobody's going to pull me out there and I'm going to die. Right. So what do? You go climb down off the high dive and go to your dad and go, "Dad, I need to go to therapy and I need to fix all these thoughts in my head." No, you jump off the high dive.
Right.
You take an action. You make a decision in that moment to do the thing that scares you, right? And you don't let your brain think about it, because the more your brain thinks about it, the more it's going to talk you out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you just go do the thing. You jump off the high dive. So I did. I jumped off the high dive. I didn't die. I climbed out of the pool. And what do you think happened? I was elated.
Yeah.
It was so fun. So I ran straight back up the ladder and I did it again. Right. So just by doing the action, I shifted my entire subconscious mind about what happens when I jump off the high dive. Before that moment, I was terrified. I thought I was going to die. After that moment, my brain made an immediate shift to, this is fun. Go do the damn thing again.
Yeah. So right? I think one of the speakers at the event we're at this weekend is Tim Grover.
Yeah.
Right? And Tim Grover wrote Relentless, which I recommend reading three times. And so Tim Grover says, don't think. Like he, like,
yeah.
You know, high performers don't think yourself out of something. And so when I went to, I did a video about this recently, a couple years ago, I went to South Africa with Joel. They all jumped off a cliff in this bungee type thing.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I was like, I'm not doing it. I was just like, I was set on not doing it. And then I just felt like such a loser after. I was like, oh my God, all these guys
felt a little ashamed.
I was thinking so much.
This is a good place that shame pushes you into action.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, actually I had a man up shirt on, so I feel like such a hypocrite. And I'm like, one day Bedros is going to come here and him and his son are going to jump off this and I won't be able to share the whole like feeling and be like, yeah, we're in the same club. I'm like, and so like, it just ate me up for the next 24 hours. And then we randomly went back because the kids that, Joel's kids wanted to do a zip line that was right beside because they loved the zip line. They were fearless. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go. And I was just like, listen, all these other people have done it. They're going to hook you up. And once you get to it, just do it. Don't think, like Tim Grover said. So I just walked up to the edge and I didn't think, oh my goodness.
Yep.
I didn't peer over the edge. I was just like, I'm going to do exactly what they said. And I did it. And it was great. And it helped me. It wasn't just like, yay, now I can jump off things. It was like, now I can do certain other things.
I've now proven to myself that when I do the thing that scares me, something good comes from it.
Right.
Right. So now you can go do it in other areas of your life.
You can do
that in your relationships. You can go do that in your business. You can do it in other areas.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's what's crucial about it is you now started to build the habit of like just doing the thing.
Right. Because I was on Brad Lee's podcast and he was like, well, I'm not just going to go jump out of a plane because some guy says I have, you know, I don't have any balls or anything. I was like, that's not the reason to do it. Like, I don't really want to jump out of a plane either, but there's more benefits to it than just proving it to somebody else. If you, like, he doesn't really have a fear problem, but if you had a fear problem, that type of thing chips away at it because the action, as you said, leads to a new belief.
Yeah. So as soon as you take that action, like, you've now created, like, if you're listening to this, think about a time when you did something that scared you. And it could be anything. It could be, you know, when you, the first time you asked your spouse on a date when you first met her or him. It could be, you know, applying for a role that you didn't think you were going to get. It could be
making a video,
like whatever it was, you felt terrified before, you had all the stories going through your head, you did it. How'd you feel after? You felt great.
Yeah.
Right. So action actually becomes, the precursor to motivation, not the other way around. Everybody thinks you need to be motivated to take action. Action is actually the precursor to motivation.
Yeah. And so what I think most people do is something bad happens and they want to go and blame somebody. They want to go backwards.
Yeah.
Like, whose fault is this? It's not my fault. Or, that was your fault that you did that. Oh my goodness. I told you so many times. Like, most people get caught in that backward argument, but you just think, well, none of that's going to make it any better.
Yeah.
Instead, what can we do about it?
Yep.
Who can help? How can we fix this? What's the one thing? And that's why I say the action beats anxiety, because anytime I felt down, none of the reverse looking back ever made it
helped.
Better.
Yeah.
No, it's always, okay, well, even if I go and do something, I'm going to go do something positive that has nothing to do with this negative, but it makes me feel a little bit better, which allows me to.
Great. Yeah. Another great example of that. Like, you and I are both introverts, yet we're both all over social media. We're all over, you know, the interwebs, right?
Yeah.
I always tell people whenever I'm feeling low, you mentioned a video, like I've been doing this for 5 years now. I still hate doing videos, right? If I just grab my phone and just shoot a video, afterwards I will feel energized. So literally when I'm feeling down or don't have energy, I'll just grab my phone and film a video. It doesn't matter what it is. I don't even have to post it. But just the act of doing that one thing that scares me makes me energized to go do something else.
That's great. Might have been. Yeah, super helpful. So we've talked about the two really big things that impacted you and led you to write this book. And you told me before there were like four key components to stuff you don't learn in college.
Yeah.
So did we talk about two of them already? Or are those like components of the components?
There's components within the components.
Got it.
This is a multi-layered thing. Overall, basically, the four pieces that we really talk about to be successful in life is number one, you have to have a foundational understanding of how you as a person operate. So this is, you know, your brain, your emotions. We were talking about the user's manual, right? Like none of us are taught, like your mom and your dad or your teachers never taught you about how your brain works. Mm-hmm. And your brain literally dictates everything in your life. It's the control center. It dictates everything. And you're never taught how to use it, right? So foundationally, you need to have an understanding of how your brain, how your emotions, how humans operate, and what it actually means to be and feel successful, to have meaning, to be fulfilled, what your desires are like really are as a human, right? And how to actually create that for yourself. So that's a foundational understanding.
Okay. So, I mean, I know that that's not something you figure out in a minute, but what's like one practical thing? Because a lot of people are, sleepwalking through life don't do the self-reflection.
By far the biggest thing around this is first understanding your brain. Your subconscious is 95%.
Okay.
Right. And that subconscious 95% will dictate the entirety of your life, right? Those 95 donkeys. So how do you actually program these 95 donkeys? So the subconscious is programmed by two things, repetition and emotion, right? So repetition, the example that I always give is they did there was a German zoologist in like the 1800s who did a study on pike, right? And so pike, for anybody who doesn't know, pike are these big, scary, ugly fish.
Mm-hmm.
And he put them in a big fish tank with a bunch of bait fish, and he put a piece of glass in between the two. So the pike, being predators, went after the bait fish headlong, and the bait fish just swam around like crazy trying to get out of there, right? Well, the pike ran into the glass so hard that it would like basically stun itself and, it almost knock itself unconscious. It would do it over and over and over. Did about 30 minutes straight, and then it stopped, and it started swimming around in circles. And the bait fish were freaking out for about 30 minutes, and then they stopped and started swimming around in circles. Then he took the piece of glass out from in between them. What do you think happened?
They just swam around in circles?
Nothing. They kept swimming. So even though the pike is the predator and wants to eat the bait fish, it was programmed by the repetition of running headlong into this glass, and it just stopped to the point when they did this study, to the point that the pike would actually die of starvation.
Wow.
The pike would die of starvation before it went back after them because it's that subconscious, the animalistic part of it, was programmed to not do that because it caused so much pain. So repetition and then emotion. So just like I said, when I lost AJ, it created an entirely new set of beliefs and behaviors for me. The way that I always tell this to everybody is like, do you remember when 9/11 happened?
Yeah.
Do you remember where you were?
Yep.
Where were you?
I was in an office building.
What do you remember?
I was working. I was working.
Yeah. Do you remember where? Like what office building?
Yeah. I remember who told me. I remember.
Who told you?
This guy, Corey.
So you vividly remember this, right?
Oh yeah.
But think
about
that. Because
we actually had a person from that job was actually in New York that day.
Were you thinking about 9/11 before I just brought this up?
No.
So that situation is so emotionally charged for most people that we will all remember exactly what was going on when we found out about 9/11.
Sure.
Even though it only happened once, it was so emotionally charging. It is deeply ingrained in our subconscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
So we all have these things throughout life that it's, repetition of the media saying something, our parents saying something, or a really emotional situation that happened to us. Now, a lot of these programs are from the ages of between 3 and 8. So while you might not think they're life-threatening situations, a 3 and 8-year-old could think that they're incredibly emotional. I remember one time when I was 5, I accidentally locked myself in a bathroom. Now as 33-year-old Xander, I think that's hilarious. As 5-year-old Xander, I legitimately thought I was gonna die. I thought I was gonna run out of air. And the reason I locked myself in the bathroom was because I kind of got in a fight with my mom about something that I knew I needed to do and she just couldn't understand it, right? So I created this belief of like, whenever I push for my way, I'm going to die, even if I know I'm right. Well, as an entrepreneur, could you ever be successful if when you know something's right, you don't make sure that that gets done? No, you'll never be successful. So we all have these subconscious programs, and we need to start to find them and unprogram them and reprogram new ones. And you do this through visualizations and affirmations, so affirming new beliefs, and also finding these old beliefs. And I have exercises for anybody, you know, anybody who ends up buying our pre-sale book. We actually have a whole e-workbook with like questions to help you. Like literally, we have a, we call it the Belief Breaker 8. So it's 8 questions that we use with every single one of our clients that will help you unprogram any of these programs. So you can do this one by one, and you can start to get rid of every single program one by one. It's 8 questions, takes about 15 minutes, and that those 8 questions will start to unprogram all of the crappy programming you have from 10, 20, 30 years back in your life.
Cool. You know, the repetition and emotion, like I once went to, you know, I used to go to events, not talk to anybody. And then I went to one of Bedros's events and I told people, I said, and you know, publicly, I'm going to go hug 100 people.
I remember
weekend.
That. Yeah.
And you know, you get, when you're not a hugger, the first couple are weird, but by the end, you're just like, it's just 100 repetitions. And it's the same with the video. I tell people do a video a day, every single day. You don't have to post it, but at the end of 30 days, people are different people.
Yeah.
Just by doing that.
Well, it's that number of repetitions, like you go hug 100 people, you've now repeated that over and over in your subconscious. It is now it's like taking a knife and grinding it into a piece of wood.
Right. And
if you keep it going 100 times, you're going to have a deep groove.
Right. And that situation was set up for success because it's hugging a lot of people I know who have good
feelings. And not during COVID.
Right. But you know, if you try and do that on the street, you might have a negative response to it. So I definitely set myself up for success. The second principle of the book.
So the second principle of the book is clarity, right? So once you understand you have to get clear on what it is that you really want.
Okay.
Not what society wants for you, not what your parents want for you, not what the school said you're good at, right? It's what do you really want and what you should be pursuing.
Mm-hmm.
And really it's interesting because it's, you know, this is the area where most people think that like finding their purpose in life is going to take an entire lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
We found it takes about 2 weeks.
Wow.
Right? It takes about 2 weeks of really intentional critical questions like we talked about, exercises, and then there's always going to be experiences that you have that are going to help you get clarity.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a handful of exercises that we give to people that they're not going to get you 100% clarity. But think of it like a jigsaw puzzle. Right? Now, if you've got a jigsaw puzzle, every little piece that you put together helps you get clearer. Now, once you get enough of the jigsaw puzzle pieces or you get some really big jigsaw puzzle pieces, you know what the picture's going to be.
Mm.
You could be 40% of the way through it. You could be 50% of the way through it. But you know what it's generally how it's going to end up once you've started to put some of these in there. And then as you go through the rest of your life, you get the rest of these pieces.
Sure.
But you can do some really intentional work, some exercises to help you get these jigsaw puzzle pieces to help get clearer a lot faster. Now, this kind of goes back to what I was talking about with, you know, the school system. We're told, I was 17 and a half when I had to make the decision of where I wanted to go to college and what my degree was going to be, right? I was 17 and a half.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to have the foresight for what I'm supposed to be doing in the future of my life when all I care about is whose party are we going to on Friday? And like that cute girl in Spanish.
Right.
Like, how am I supposed to decide that? That's crazy. So, you know, most of us end up going down that path. Then we go to school. Then we pay a bunch of money for a degree that we don't want. So we have to get into a role that we don't want. And we continue down that path and we accrue more debt. We get more mortgages and things like that. And we just build ourselves into this corner until we reach a midlife crisis. And that's when we make a change.
Mm-hmm.
We go, what am I doing with my life? Because I'm on the second half now.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be that way if you just get clarity first and then make your decisions from there.
Okay. Third.
Right? So third is execution. So in my opinion, execution is a skill, right? And it's a skill that we're never taught. So execution, we've basically broken down execution into a handful of habits really that need to be built and mastered. Mastery takes time. It takes repetition. But they're all skills that we're never taught in school. Right. So when it comes to execution, one of the first things that we tell people is you have to make courageous decisions.
Mm-hmm. Like quitting your job. Yeah.
Right. So you have to make courageous decisions. This is by far one of the most important things that you can do. in terms of being an executor.
Right. Just I'm not telling everybody to quit their job today. I'm just saying Xander quit his job, but he quit a well-paying job and he was on the ups.
Yeah,
so it wasn't like he was in a dead-end job.
Yeah, I wasn't at a dead-end job. And everybody's like, oh, but Xander, you made so much money. You had all this money squirreled away. Like, you were fine for the next 3 years. No, you guys, I was a millennial.
Right.
Do you think
and you lived in California.
And I lived in California. And I had about 3 months worth of living expenses.
Wow.
And I spent all of it in the first 30 days. So the next 2-3 months, I was living off of credit cards. My credit cards were maxed out.
Wow.
I had about 2 to 3 weeks left on what I could pay on credit cards before I was going to have a rent check or a rent bill that came in that I was not going to pay.
Hmm.
And I hadn't made any money at that point. So I was literally on the edge of being on the street, right?
So you have to make a courageous decision as part of execution.
What else? You have to learn to make more courageous decisions as part of executing. And it becomes a habit, right? Just doing the things that scare you.
Yeah.
The other thing that we tell people is failing, right? You have to be willing to fail, right? Like, I don't, as an entrepreneur, but actually this is a good question for you. As an entrepreneur, what percentage of the things that you try actually end up working and, you know, scaling up?
Well, way less than half.
Way less than half.
Yeah.
Like
I
would probably say for me, it might be, and maybe I'm a shitty entrepreneur, but like I'd say maybe 20%, right? Like I'd say 20% of the things that I go after, like end up just really being that thing that like ends up shooting up and scaling. That means 4 out of 5 times, like it fails. Now think about college or think about school in general. You get one shot at the test. You don't get that A, you don't get that A. You get one shot at your project. In your 9-to-5, you get one shot at that presentation. So you're programmed to prepare more and execute less.
Got it.
So they found, Forbes did another study, they found that 77% of self-made millionaires were not A students.
Hmm.
They were high majority were C, and then some were B.
Okay.
Because C students were willing to just put out good enough and just get it done and move forward.
Got it.
Right? And what they found is A students wanted it to be perfect. They thought and they planned and they perfected, but that actually kills you in the real world.
Got it.
So being willing to execute faster and fail more is the other thing. And the third thing when it comes to execution is actually review. And so reviewing and getting feedback. And this is something you do and you've taught me a ton on is like reviewing and reflecting.
Sure.
Right? Now, you know, the example I always give here is let's say when I was first starting my coaching business, I had the goal of getting to, I made the crazy big goal when I first quit my job. I said, 1 year from now, 12 months from now, I'm going to make 100K a month in my business, right? I did that.
Yeah.
I made that 100K a month, literally that 12th month. But how many days of that year did I actually hit that goal?
Very few.
One time.
Yeah.
One day during that entire year. One day during 365. So the rest of that year, is reviewing and reflecting on your goals fun? No. It hurts every single day when you look back and you go, well, why didn't this work? Why am I not there yet? It hurts every single time. So most people don't want to reflect and learn from whatever it is that they did wrong. And, you know, they end up, you know, Einstein said, and I think a lot of people said this, but Einstein's the one that's always quoted on the internet. You know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Right.
Right. Well, you can be an action taker. You can be an executor. You can fail forward, but if you're never reviewing and reflecting to learn from your mistakes, you are destined to keep running headlong into the same wall.
Right. It's like playing golf and never, you know, I'm just going to play golf every day for the rest of your life. Like you're just not going to get better.
And you know, from an execution standpoint, those are kind of the three basics, but actually mastering those three, like you and I both know, you could know those three things intellectually, but mastering them in terms of like how you implement them, your subconscious being willing to fail constantly. Why don't we want to fail? Well, because of shame. We don't want to be judged. We don't want to be criticized. So it's literally hitting on your deep evolutionary fears of being outcast and then killed by a saber-toothed tiger.
Right.
To be able to will, you know, we all know that we need to fail more, but none of us do it.
Because, by the way, I didn't know that was a rhetorical question. I thought it was a game show.
You had the right answer.
Yeah.
You had the right answer. So that's
because I also wanted
that's all that matters.
I wanted to make up for the other question where I didn't know the answer. There was 20% of the things. So the fourth component of
and,
the book.
And the fourth component is you have to have tactical strategies.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, this is kind of where I think there's a lot of self-improvement books and success books that are out there that are great at helping you shift your mindset, helping you get clarity and all of these different things, but they don't teach you the tactics of, okay, what can I actually do today? what can I implement now? What are the tools? What are the exercises? What are the things that I can start doing right now to get clarity? What are the tools that I can use? You know, you talked about so building the habit of just not thinking and doing something.
Right.
One of the best things that I have ever found for that is cold. So cold showers, cold plunges. I have a cold plunge. We just went down and saw my cold plunge in our backyard. I have a cold plunge that I go into every single morning. And it has taught me how to act without thinking. Because cold is the only thing that will make you react. The way that you felt jumping off of that high line, right? The second time you go do it, your norepinephrine, your hormones, your adrenaline will be a fourth of what it was that first time.
Wow.
Cold is the only thing that will be that same level, 350% of what it normally is. It will only be like that for cold every single time. So every single morning when I go into that cold plunge at, you know, 6:30 in the morning or whatever it is, I look at it and it terrifies me.
Yeah, yeah.
But then every single morning.
But then
I stop thinking and I just walk up to it and I get in.
Right.
And it's cold as shit every single time. But you get out and you feel motivated, inspired, elated. Because I just got in this freezing cold thing for 2 minutes, 3 minutes. I accomplished something difficult. First thing in the morning, the rest of my day is easy.
Got it.
Right? So it's simple things like that, simple tools that you can use to start to shift your brain, literally start to change your hormones, your neurons, everything like that. We give a lot of tactics around sales and influence, right? Because, you know, sales and influence is everything in this world. You know, one of the things that I tell people is sales and leadership.
Hey, well, yeah. Let's stop that for a second. Sales and influence is everything in this world. And people go, what do you mean by that? Because influence is persuasion. And so it's not necessarily like about money.
No, not at all.
Right. So right?
Well,
talk about.
Let me put it this way. When you first met Michelle, if you didn't have the ability to influence her or persuade her to going on a date with you, you would not have a wife.
Right.
Right. So every single one of us, we use persuasion and influence to create a life with more money, more meaning, and more freedom. All the other things, right? Relationships, everything is
getting your kids to brush their teeth.
Getting your kids to brush their teeth
and persuasion
is sales. And I always tell people, sales and leadership are actually the same thing, right? So
Sure. Nobody
wants to be a salesperson, but everybody wants to be a leader.
Yeah.
Right. But they're the same thing. They're both influence and persuasion, right? Leadership. You know who was one of the best leaders to walk the face of the earth? Hitler. Terrible person.
Right. Horrible
person. Terrible person.
Persuaded people to do a lot of things.
But a very, very strong leader, right? You know who was one of the best salespeople? Martin Luther King. He sold the entire world on a new way of thinking, right? So sales and leadership are not good or bad. They are just a tool to be used. And if you use them for bad things,
right,
it's going to create bad outcomes. If you use them for good things, they're going to create good outcomes, right?
So, and it's funny. So I was telling Michelle this the other day, Robert Cialdini's book, Influence.
Yeah.
Robert Cialdini was a scientist, and he originally wrote the book Influence to protect...
Prevent people from basically war propaganda.
Well, and to prevent people from getting ripped off.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, hey, this is like... You know, I'm going to help the consumer here so that you don't get persuaded to buy something you don't want. And it ended up being marketers just
took
it as
a marketing bible.
Right. And now Cialdini realized like, oh, there's money in this. And so, you know, he
wrote Persuasion.
Right. He wrote Persuasion and really has like a business around it. I mean, it's just fascinating.
But it's, you know, it's really important for everybody to understand, like, if you want to have a life that you feel successful, you will have to learn skills like that, like sales and leadership. And so we have, you know, all of our frameworks of the 5 steps to sell anything without selling anything. We have the 9 principles of leadership in there. So, you know, we actually have to teach a lot of these specific tactics, specific strategies of how to actually do these things as well, because, you know, just the mindset stuff alone won't get you there.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, that's awesome. Super excited for this book to come out.
Yep.
That's going to be great. So it's officially for launch on October 19th.
The official launch is October 19th. We are on pre-sale now.
How do people get it?
Yeah. So right now you can go to sidlickbook.com. That's S-Y-D-L-I-C. So that's shit you don't learn in college, or stuff you don't learn in college. Sorry.
Sidlickbook.com?
Book.com. So S-Y-D-L-I-C-book.com. And you can get your pre-sale version of it right now. Along with the pre-sale, we're actually, for every pre-sale copy that's bought, we're buying a week of meals for a kid in Kenya, a starving kid in Kenya. We're giving you, just like I talked about, the whole e-workbook with all the exercises, all the questions. I'm also giving away two of my best-selling courses that we have. Nice. One of them, I've actually previously sold one-on-one for $5,000. We sell it as a self-study course for $1,000, $997.
Wow.
It's our Shit You Don't Learn in College 101 course. We're giving you that for free.
Nice.
We're also giving away what I call my GSD or Get Shit Done training. It's a productivity training that I use with my team. It helped me be really successful in Cisco, and now we teach, you know, everybody. I go give corporate talks around it for about $2,000.
Nice.
We're giving that to you guys for free as well.
Awesome.
Yep. So
Sidlickbook.com.
Yep.
And then for your podcast?
You can check us out on Apple, on Spotify, Google Podcasts, all of that fun stuff.
What's it called?
Again, Shit You Don't Learn in College.
With Xander Fryer.
With Xander Fryer. So you can check us out there too.
Awesome. Xander, dude, awesome.
Thank you for having me into the house.
Man. And being here, everybody, make sure you go to sidlickbook.com, get that, and then hit me up on Instagram at @RealCraigValentine. Let me know what you thought of today's episode and give us a 5-star review over on iTunes and all those places. And then if you want to email us questions or comments, go to support@earlytorise.com, and we look forward to hearing from you soon. Oh, and drop a comment down below if you're watching this on the tubes.